think I realized in January it was a huge story. I don't think I realized until much more recently that it was the story of our lifetime. 9/11 changed our world, and this is going to change our world too in ways that we don't understand yet.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. Today, we're bringing you a special edition of Women Rule to talk about the coronavirus pandemic that has quickly transformed life in America and much of the world. That voice you heard at the beginning, that's Joanne Kennan, the executive editor of Politico's healthcare coverage, which puts her on the front lines of a crisis that is threatening lives and gutting the economy. All the while, Joanne says, the U.S. continues to lag far behind where it needs to be.
If we really sort of woke up to this in January, we'd have more things in place in March. And instead, in March, we're mobilizing to get things in place in May.
For the last week and a half, those of us at Politico have been working from home in an effort to help flatten the curve and slow the spread of the coronavirus. So Joanne and I spoke via a video conference, which is why this might sound a bit different than a typical episode. We talked through many of the questions we've all been thinking about the last few weeks, from the shortage of masks and respirators to the age of social isolation, to when we can expect this to end, and what it all could look like in retrospect.
I mean, in a pandemic year, I think I looked it up, I think it was 1957, and if I'm remembering the number correctly, I think it was something like 119,000 Americans. A few weeks ago, I thought that's what we were looking at as a worst case scenario. Now we know from the public health people, the worst case scenario, I don't want to say it's going to be worst case scenario. It looks like it won't be the worst case scenario, but it would be way more than 100,000 dead.
And now, here's my conversation with Joanne Kennan.
I wonder if you can take me through what you're doing in your home and your life to kind of protect yourself from the coronavirus at this time.
Well, other than recording a podcast from my closet, you know, my family has really hunkered down, and it's hard. I have a 19-year-old who just came home very abruptly and very unhappily. He was in a gap year overseas. He had 24 hours to book him a flight and get him pack up and leave stuff behind. And it was really stressful. And now he is home and bored and miserable and not knowing when he can return to a normal life or when he if college is going to start normally in the fall. I have a young adult son living in New York. He has decided to ride it out in New York. That's stressful. And I have an 85-year-old mother. And a couple of weeks ago, right before the clampdown, I went up to try to convince her she needed to buy food and had a fight with her about frozen vegetables. I was like, am I really fighting with my mother about eating her vegetables? I check in with her and my sisters and brother. We're all trying to check in all the time and gave books on tape advice to a lovely 7-year-old in my family that he really needs to read the Judy Blume series of Tales on a Fourth Grade of a Fourth Grade Nothing. That'll keep him through a pandemic.
There you go. Well, for a lot of people, I think clearly for myself, I'm on planes usually once to twice a week. The speed of all of the changes we've seen to daily life has been stunning. I mean, everyone's grounded. They're kind of stuck in their houses. What has happened in the last month that has surprised you?
I think within our office, people thought I was a little alarmist back in January when I said things like, you know, we have to think about whether we'll be able to have normal elections and we're going to have to think about whether we could have a normal convention. And people sort of thought I was maybe overreacting. And in retrospect, I think I was underreacting. It is worse than I anticipated. It's hard to measure what isn't happening. So as I speak to you on Monday, you know, do we know whether social distancing is what they call flattening the curve, making fewer people get sick at once, which allows our hospitals to cope with the people who are sick. I think it's probably working, trying to get to a degree, trying to get data on something that didn't happen is hard. And also because the testing in this country was so late and so insufficient in the opening days, we don't really know what the baseline was to tell whether it's getting better or worse. You know, all we can do is hope. That's our best tool, is just social distancing. We don't have a drug yet. We don't have a vaccine yet. And our hospitals aren't really ready. So stay home.
Well, I want to rewind a little bit and understand kind of how we got here, which I think is a question that goes through a lot of people's minds. And you were talking before about being, you know, kind of almost perceived maybe internally as alarmist. When did
I don't
you?
Think anyone thought I was hysterical, but I think people thought I was on the. You know, I am sort of, you know, as Anna can attest, I am sort of the office mom to an extent. I'm one of the office moms. And I was alarmed early on, and I have been covering public health for years, and I knew a pandemic was going to come one of these days. Right. I didn't know it was this one. But even in, as we were having conversations in January and February, I didn't think it would be a 1918 comparison. I thought it would be something not quite as bad as what we are potentially facing. You know, I'm hoping the United States doesn't get to be Italy, but we don't know yet how bad it's going to get.
When did you realize this was going to be kind of a huge story?
I think I realized in January it was a huge story. I don't think I realized until much more recently that it was the story of our lifetime. And I hope it is the worst thing that ever happens in our lifetime. I mean, for me as a mom, 9/11 was my very first day back from maternity leave with my second child. And I was in the White House. I covered the Hill at that point, but I happened to be at the White House when plane number one hit. And it was the first time I was away from my baby, my second child. And I was with Laura Bush in a motorcade when plane number two hit. And I was on the Hill when plane number three hit. And we could see the Pentagon, smoke from the Pentagon. So I thought that was the biggest story I'd ever covered. And I hoped that that was the biggest, scariest story I ever covered. I mean, for every American, it was an awful day. For me as a mom, that was the worst work day I've ever had. This is a slower motion, less of a shock. We've seen it coming. 9/11 changed our world. And this is going to change our world, too, in ways that we don't understand yet. So it's not just the story of today and tomorrow and next week. It's the story of the months to come. And what is how do we heal? How do we recover?
I mean, one of the things that I think a lot of people wonder is, how is this first kind of always being described against the flu, or whether this was going to be worse than the flu, or the flu was worse than the coronavirus? Why do you think that? Is it just because people didn't know what was happening or didn't have anything else to, you know, compare it against?
I think partly because we were told, I mean, President Trump and others, not just President Trump, but President Trump was telling us it was like the flu. And in some ways, it's a useful comparison because it's an invisible enemy that hits you and it's hard to protect yourself. But it's way more dangerous than the flu in terms of, you know, we don't shut our economy down because of the flu. This is very contagious. Scientists, it's brand new. They never saw it. So some of what we thought we knew, or scientists and public health and epidemiologists thought they knew in January, turns out not to be true, or not to be totally true in how it spread and how contagious it is, and how at the beginning we thought you could only get it from someone who had symptoms. Now we know there's a certain amount of asymptomatic spread, or people, maybe they have symptoms, but it's so mild they don't realize that's what it is. We're learning that people are getting it by touching something. So think about, you know, a tray, an elevator button, a doorknob. I mean, we're supposed to go around, you know, wiping those things off now. So the flu is really contagious, but the flu doesn't kill as many people. I mean, in a pandemic year, I think I looked it up. I think it was 1957. And if I'm remembering the number correctly, I think it was something like 119,000 Americans. I might be wrong because I looked it up a few days ago. So, but it was over 100,000, well over 100,000. A few weeks ago, I thought that's what we were looking at as a worst case scenario. Now we know from the public health people the worst case scenario. And we may not get to the worst case scenario. I don't want to say it's going to be worst case scenario. It looks like it won't be the worst case scenario, but it would be way more than 100,000 dead. And that was the highest flu in decades. That was in the 1950s.
So talk to me about one of the other issues that I feel like has really come up clearly in conversations that I've been having with friends who are in the industry, which is this lack of supplies, ventilators, masks. I mean, that seems to be where really a lot of kind of this preparedness and the lack of it, there's a real honing in on kind of this could be, you know, the difference between life and death for a lot of people.
Yes, because patient A who has coronavirus, if there's not enough protective gear, they can infect patient B who doesn't have coronavirus. We do think that might be part of what's going on in Italy is spread within the hospitals. Secondly, if healthcare workers can't protect themselves, you sure do not want healthcare workers either getting sick or being quarantined for 2 weeks and then not being able to take care of those of us who get sick. So the personal protective gear, which means masks, gowns, gloves, those whatever those little slippery things are called, all these things, the masks being the most, and the respirator masks, N95s, those are really, really, really important to the healthcare system. Had this country really woken up in January and started figuring out Where are they? How can we make more? How can we enlist other factories to make more? How do we come up with a national allocation system to make sure they're going to the cities and communities that need them priority versus the cities that only have one case? Who are going to need them down the road? It's not that we can leave them totally unprotected, but do you want the, where do you want the emergency shipments to go? How do you want to prioritize things? It doesn't make sense to have a ventilator for every American, but we don't have enough. So A, we should have planned better, and B, we should have planned better over the years for the inevitable pandemic. And that goes back many years, both Democratic and Republican administrations and Congress, and who didn't want to spend money and what they wanted to spend money on, et cetera, et cetera. But also, if we really sort of woke up to this in January, we'd have more things in place in March. And instead, in March, we're mobilizing to get things in place in May. That's why the social distancing is so important. It doesn't mean that people won't get sick, but if not as many get sick at once, doctors will be able to take care of us better.
But the other big issue that's clearly been a big issue is the testing and kind of the lack of the test being there, how long it's kind of the lapse in terms of from when the people get the test to when they actually get the results. What happened there?
Our test didn't work. We decided to use a CDC test, and the CDC is usually able to do this. This time, they've done tests in the past. They've been the leaders around the world in other pandemics and global health threats. But this time the CDC made a test and it simply did not work. There was probably some kind of contamination in the manufacturing process. It's still being investigated. What we do know is it worked in the CDC, and when they sent it out into the state labs, into the communities, it simply did not work. Taking weeks and weeks to get a test that worked put us way behind the curve. And we were slow. Some medical schools and academic medical centers were developing their own. There is a way to use emergency powers to approve those things quickly. You do have to approve them. You just can't let anybody decide, I'm going to make a coronavirus test. But you can expedite. There are emergency ways that you can expedite. We finally, the FDA figured it out. They started expediting. But it took them weeks to expedite. They had those tools. President Trump is saying, you know, it's the fault of the prior administrations for tying their hands. No, there were tools to get things. That has nothing to do with making whether the test worked or not. It has nothing to do with whether you can quickly get another test. Germany developed tests. Korea developed tests. China developed tests. The WHO was sending its test out to something like 60 other countries by February, and we decided not to use that. The CDC has now said, well, we don't think their test is good enough. Well, we didn't have a test. If you want to develop the perfect gold standard test, fine, but I don't know anybody outside of government who thinks it was okay to not use another test, at least as a temporary bridge. Use what's available and then try it. If you make a better one, make a better one. But we've created this dichotomy. Okay, we're going to use nothing or wait for the perfect one instead of using the best available at the time.
I want to talk a little bit about your coverage. You run our healthcare team. A lot of the coverage that your team has done has focused on the administration's response, some of the infighting at the agencies. Talk about what are one or two of the bigger stories that your team has been able to kind of plant a flag to say, this is a really important kind of turning point for our coverage here.
We have been way ahead of the curve on the testing problems. We've reported on the failures. We've reported, I mean, we were not the only outlet. Everybody, there's a lot of really great journalism doing, but we have been really ahead of the curve. We have a reporter who specializes in testing and diagnostics. We had just hired him, I think something like 2 weeks before this began. I hired a medical device reporter, not knowing that I hired somebody who was going to have this peculiar interest, unique ability to know everything about developing diagnostic tests. So he's been really good. I've written about the WHO and the international testing and this testing gaps. We've really been good on that story. We've written a lot about, you know, on one hand, you can say, well, the personality conflicts, on one hand, it doesn't matter right now, like who likes who and who's up and who's down. There's one level that it doesn't matter. It does matter if it's affecting clear, consistent policies from moving ahead. If people are fighting or not sure who's in charge, or there's somebody different in charge every day, or we're focusing on this department. It took a long time for the president to get FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. They didn't get involved until a few days ago. So all these fights over, you know, who's making decisions, who's in the good graces of the White House, they aren't petty to the extent that they are preventing us from having a coherent and cohesive national strategy where we figure out what we need to do and we get it done.
One of the things that, you know, this is obviously a Women Rule podcast, and one of the things I think has been very interesting when you look at the first wave of the coronavirus task force, all men. We've seen some women come kind of be players that aren't household names necessarily maybe to the lay people, but you were probably familiar with. Would love to just kind of go through some of those figures and get your reaction, who they are, why they're important. I think the first one, obviously, Dr. Birx, who now has an office in the White House. Talk to us a little bit about Deborah Birx, what her background is, kind of what role she's playing now.
She is not someone I personally had been aware of before. And I know there's sort of a joke in the newsroom that I know everybody through the PTA, but she apparently wasn't on my PTA. She's really impressive. She was not part of the first wave of responders. Vice President Pence, when he became in charge, he named her within a day or two. We see her almost every day at the White House at the briefings. She has that ability to explain scientifically cumbersome ideas into plain English so that the public can understand what's going on. She's very good at explaining things. Tony Fauci is another one who's good at that, but she can do that. She can take concepts that we're not familiar with and that we're frightened by and lay them out in a way that the public can understand. She's also talked about her own family. She sort of does have, you know, a fairly, I don't want to use soft in a pejorative way. I mean, there's something approachable about her. You can sort of relate to her, maybe just me. I mean, I can listen to her and feel a certain amount of reassurance. I see a mom up there. She always has, you know, a nice scarf. And there's sort of this signal saying, you know, I'm not coming on national TV in my pajamas. And I think those of us working at home sort of can take, you know, the need to sort of create some structure in your life and take care of yourself and try to create some little window of normalcy. In addition to being, you know, this kick-ass scientist, she also creates that image. She sort of seems to be above the fray in a way that very few other people are right now.
Somebody who has kind of not kept out of the fray was Seema Verma. You kind of alluded to her earlier. We've seen her a bit more, I think, in the last couple of days and weeks than probably people outside of Washington might not even know who she is.
She runs Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare, in fact, through something called the Center for Medicare Services. It's the second biggest job at HHS after the secretary. There's often been friction over the years between CMS administrators and the Secretary of Health and Human Services because it is such a huge program within HHS. We have reported before coronavirus on how those tensions in this administration between Secretary Azar and Administrator Verma were quite acute and creating dysfunction. That sort of personal battle seems to be a little bit on hold in public at the moment. She was not on the initial task force. She was part of the second wave of people that were added. She is relevant for a number of reasons. Medicare and Medicaid create the regulatory structure for an awful lot of how healthcare is delivered in this country and how it's paid for and what the rules are that doctors and hospitals have to follow by waiving, modifying rules, granting extra flexibility. She has given them more agility to respond to emergencies such as changing the rules about telemedicine, you know, the ways in which people, particularly older people who are housebound, can seek advice from doctors and doctors can get reimbursed for that. CMS also regulates nursing homes. And as we've seen in Washington State, that's a really dangerous place once the virus gets in. I think there's something like 35 deaths now. I'm not sure if I'm totally correct on that, but there's a lot of illness and death in that nursing home in Kirkland, Washington. And I don't think we're done with seeing because it spread to other nursing homes in Washington. Again, that goes back to the testing, right? And so Seema Verma can regulate the nursing homes, can really focus on this infection control, but also that testing, we go back to the testing. If we knew it was in the country, if we weren't just being told it was kept out because of travel restrictions, people would have been more alert. In retrospect, there were two deaths at that nursing home before anyone realized they were coronavirus. And then more people got infected. And some of the workers in that nursing home work in other nursing homes in the state of Washington and in the Seattle area, and they spread it. So that's the kind of thing that Seema Verma is trying to, you know, how to isolate and protect some of our most vulnerable people and care for them in nursing homes.
All right. Well, I want to take a step back a little bit and talk a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up? Where are you from?
Oh, like everybody? Didn't everybody grow up in New Jersey? I grew up in New Jersey with a little bit of California. Then, you know, when I always knew I wanted to be a journalist, like since second grade, Anna. Remember that community unit in second grade? And you had the little post office. So we had the Teeny Town Times in second grade. And ever since then, that's what I wanted to do. I've developed some skills I didn't have in second grade. But that's it.
When did you decide that you wanted to go into health reporting?
I had done a little bit of health reporting, you know, as I was a general reporter in other community. I mean, I worked in New York and I actually covered some HIV earlier in my career. And I worked overseas. I lived in Latin America. I worked in Miami and covered the Caribbean and some of Latin America from there.
Talk about that. So you started out as a reporter of Reuters, mid-80s. At the time, as you mentioned, there was a little understood, but high mortality rate disease, HIV and AIDS. How does this moment compare to that, kind of the uncertainty around it? Are there similarities, things or kind of through lines that you see from that reporting?
Well, I think the stigma around AIDS because of the populations that it affected, and I was not a full-time health reporter then, but I was living in New York, so I did report on it. It spread differently. It was associated, I mean, remember our society has changed a lot about how we treat and think about, you know, our gay friends and family. It was much more stigmatic in the 1980s. Drug users was the other way that it was spreading, and it was in Africa. So America was not always at its greatest. There was a lot of stigma, a lot of fear. I mean, there's fear now, but it was a fear of specific people. And here it's more of a fear of a really dangerous germ. It's been really hard. It was harder to treat. It took us years to come up with good treatments. We saw young people dying in large numbers. In this case, we are testing some drugs that there's some drugs that are already on the market, or there's some drugs that are in the pipeline that have already been through some testing. We, you know, let's hope we'll get treatments that it won't take 15 years. I don't want to overpromise, but there are things worth looking at that can at least, you know, they may not be a cure, but if we can prevent you from dying, that's a good thing. We still don't have an AIDS vaccine. All, you know, billions of dollars and years, you know, there people spent their entire life trying to develop one. We don't have it. But I think this affects everybody. And it's not exactly the same because this is a pandemic that's spreading so fast and everybody is vulnerable to getting it, including young people, if you're listening. There's some parallels and it's new and frightening, but the way we've responded is not the same.
Talk about that, though. This is clearly a time where people are very uncertain about what the future holds on pretty much every front. And I think a lot of people, every conversation I have with family and friends, it turns to when is life going to return to normal? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't think we know yet. Secretary Mnuchin has talked about another, I think, 10 to 12 weeks of sort of the hunker down stage. President Trump is tweeting about, you know, maybe we can't go that long. I think that it'll be interesting to watch that dynamic. By the time people listen to this, we may have more clarity about what the president is going to say about that. I don't think it's, you know, years, obviously. I don't think it's 2 weeks. I think that we are in for a period of disruption. And I think it'll be prolonged until we're back to, quote, whatever normal, unquote, is post-pandemic. I don't think we're going to get back to normal in a couple of months. I think we may get over this really intense hunker down stage, I would hope. I mean, my kid really wants to get out of this house. Let's hope that Secretary Mnuchin's sort of 10-12 week prediction is a realistic time frame. This is our only tool, you know, the hunker down prescription. You know, if we get a treatment in a couple of months, we'll have some clinical trials results in April. I mean, the sooner we get data, the more we know what's to come. It's really hard to understand, but important to understand that when public health works and things don't happen, then people think, well, we didn't need to do all that. Look, there were only X cases, but that means it doesn't mean that we didn't need it. It's this, I mean, it's one reason public health has so much trouble getting funded, because when it succeeds, it looks like, instead of saying, oh, we need to keep spending on that.
Well, do you have any advice for people who are preparing for the long haul, kind of beyond the hand sanitizer and Lysol? Are there practical things we can be doing?
I'm trying to, that balance of making sure you have what you need in your home so you don't have to keep going out. You want to minimize your shopping trips and you want to, you know, Purell and wash when you do have to go out of the house. And if you're really older and vulnerable, maybe have a neighbor shop for you, or get things delivered if that's an option where you live and you're economically able to do that. A lot of places are not charging a lot of money to deliver or to pick up your groceries without going into the store to have them shop. So on one hand, yes, you want to get what you need. You know, if you're one of those people who wanted to go to the store every day to get fresh fruit, try to do it once a week. But I think also I've been grappling with, you know, we're working really hard and we're working really long hours. And I think it's also important to figure out how we take care of ourselves as we're under pressure. And I don't have the answers. I mean, over the weekend, I made sure I went for walks. because my day is dictated somewhat by the news events, it's hard for me to figure out when am I going to go for a walk today. And to try to just sort of be connected to people, try to understand what the people around you are going through, and to be, you know, empathetic, and try to find time to be a human being, to be a wife, mother, sister, daughter, old friend. I think trying to call some older people I know who are more isolated, I'm trying to do that as well. I'm trying to tip well when I have anyone deliver something, because people are going to be, it's a hard time. I've given money to charity that I might normally have done in December. I've done it now, particularly organizations that get food out to people. And just trying to figure out what is normal, making sure, you know, that, you know, even if I wear the sweatpants every day, I try to put on a nice shirt.
It's all a balance, like most in life. We are quickly running out of time, but I do want to kind of end on hopefully a more positive note, because I think, like you said, I mean, a lot of this new normal is trying to figure out how do you kind of take care of yourself, and how can we find hope. We don't know when this is going to end. There's a lot we don't know about supplies and kind of what our futures in the short term. But given all that you do know, is there anything giving you reason to hope right now?
You know, without really solid data, and you know, we just had an editor's meeting and we were trying to figure out, are we bending this curve? Are we flattening this curve? Watching New York in particular, it looks like the supply chain is improving a little bit, not where we need to be, but it looks like it's incrementally getting better. I think I was more worried about the worst case scenario a few days ago than I am right now, which doesn't mean I'm optimistic or that I don't think it's going to be bad. I do think it's going to be bad. And I think as we try, I think also the challenge of those of us, you know, living this, it is the biggest story of our lifetime to cover, and we're also participants in it. So, I mean, taking care of myself, taking care of my family, those in the house and those that I'm talking to remotely, sort of balancing that, my sort of human reactions and my professional reactions, I am still extremely worried. I think we've made a huge amount of mistakes. I do see some of them being somewhat corrected. There's some governors who have really stepped up and taken control, at least in their states, but we have not had a consistent, accurate national strategy to make the best decisions we could make all along. A week or two ago, I mean, a former public health official sent me an email for all of Politico saying your coverage is helping save lives. And that's probably the most important thing any of us in this virtual political newsroom will do and be able to be proud of going forward.
Joanne, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anna.
Women Rule is produced by Zach Stanton. Irene Noguchi is the executive producer of Politico Audio. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866.